Happy New Year, chatters!
Happy New Year.
And we forgot for a moment how to use our microphones, but we seem to have sorted it out.
I'm just back at work from what ended up really being a proper, like, I took 3 months of leave without pay after finishing off that Parliament House series that nearly killed us all. And I really have had a proper break. And I got back to work yesterday. I'm just like, they've really messed with me by changing the entry foyer downstairs at the ABC. So I walked in, I'm just like, oh my God, it's not even the same century. It's turned into like.
So the garden variety returning to work discombobulations just enhanced even further.
And then plus the old, you need your password. My what? Oh, no idea what that is. So like 4 hours later on the phone to IT help.
Well, my return to work was a little hairy because I had a bit of a stumble when I was on holidays and got one of a black eye.
I shouldn't be laughing. It's very upsetting.
It was actually a bit, you know how when you fall over, you do something like that and then about 5 minutes later the shock sets in and you start crying uncontrollably and shaking? It was like that. I was walking along the street. It was when I was in New York. That's almost like a clang, isn't it, to drop that you're in New York?
Yeah, it just is.
It was absolutely freezing the whole time I was there, hovering around minus 10 to minus
15. You were there during the ice bomb weeks.
Oh, I was. I was wearing
your luck's really holding out, isn't it, champ?
I was wearing gloves and a big jacket, but it was so cold I had my hands shoved deep into my pockets.
Oh no.
And then I tripped on something and I could not get my hands out. And so I literally face planted. I heard my head hit the pavement. It was horrible.
What I love though is that you then immediately posted a photograph of yourself with this ginormous shiner on the Facebook group and you look kind of elegant. Like you wear that black eye really well.
Well, I had the rest of my face was made up and I just thought it was one of those things where I realised after a while, oh no, all my holiday stuff, so I'm going to look like sort of half a zombie because I've got this black ring around
one eye. Unless
you
do them all ABBA style, just profile. Imagine like, here's me, my selfie in front of this, you know.
I did do that a bit with my friend Jenny Brocky was in New York at the same time. It was her birthday and we went out to dinner and we got a shot together and Jenny said, look, just lean in close and I'll lean in towards you and just see if you can hide that eye behind my hair. And the shot actually worked out quite well. Just half my face is in shadow, but other than that, it was perfectly fine. But I'll talk about some stuff I did in New York later, but I...
Can I talk about my bum first?
Oh, yeah. Wow, chatters, actually, that was the highlight of the Christmas holidays. I've had a look at Annabelle Crabb's bum by a photo, by a transatlantic photo.
And this will not be posted in the show notes.
Trans-Pacific photo, I should say. And actually in real life as well.
Actually, because Gwen saw your picture on the group and just said, it sounds all right. Like she seems to have, or maybe it was Miranda, I can't remember. Somebody anyway picked it up and just said, what the hell's going on with Sales? She's got a massive smashed up face injury. And I had a look and went, oh, holy crap. But as it happened, and I mean, one day when we have enough time, i.e. never, we should work out if we actually fell at the same time because I slipped on the stairs at my house because I've got like carpeted stairs for no good reason except keeping things quiet with children rumpeting around. And I just slightly missed the step or like just my heel just kind of got the edge and I just went down on my ass. I didn't go bumpity bumpity bump, just one bump.
One bum.
And it was just like, oh, wow. But I was in a real hurry, so I was running around doing things. And it wasn't really till the next day
that
I
thought. You didn't put ice on your bum immediately or anything like that?
No, I didn't ice my bum that day. But I mean, wouldn't you ice your bum? I wouldn't ice my bum.
I wouldn't
ice my bum if it was a donut, lady.
You know what? You know what? Having now seen your bum injury, I would ice my bum. But prior to having seen that, I wouldn't have because I would have thought, oh, there's padding there. That's what I would have thought. How can it bruise up so bad? But chatters, let me tell you, it was a whole, it was like one bum cheek was a plum.
Yeah, it was a bum plum.
It was pretty bad.
And I, you know, a day later, I finally just, you know, was getting in the shower. I thought, I'll just take a quick look at that because it's still quite sore. And it was just like an old lady bruise, like a full purple, horrifying. Anyway, and so when I finally took the photo, I actually had my sister-in-law assist with the taking of the photograph. So thanks, Margot, for that. Weirdest thing she's ever had to do for me. And I was like, can you just photograph my ass so I can send it to Lee Sales? And she's just like, oh, my God. Righto.
It was quite a treat to wake up to a snowy morning in New York. Yeah. Oh, lovely. A message from Annabelle.
And your response is like, oh, my God, that's hideous. And the bruises are quite nasty too.
Well, I'm glad for you that you're not in porn or some sort of business like that.
I think we're both glad about that. I don't think I'd last very long.
No, but I had to last week send makeup a photo of my face to say, and it's much better now, but because it had sort of over the 2 weeks had just sort of morphed around into different things, and it had quite a dark, apparently what is called a blood stain under it on my cheek. And
you just looked like you'd been shat on by a very unwell seagull.
And I sent it to makeup to say normal concealer ain't going to cover this. You need to break out the drama concealer.
Or eye patch.
But now it's actually quite a bit better. So, yeah, not so good. But do you know what one of the pleasures of being on holiday is when you have a long-haul flight is the ability to binge watch a whole season of something in one go.
Wow.
And do you know what
so
I did?
So you watch television shows on a flight. For me, it's just only books and movies.
Does reading a book make you fall asleep, though?
Depends which class I'm flying. Like, I've never flown business overseas, I don't think, but I think the higher class you are in an aircraft, the more you want to stay awake.
I just find reading, I don't know if I'm, you know, under rested or whatever, but often if I read in the day, it makes me not off and have a nap.
No.
Make you not off?
No.
Oh, okay. That's good to know.
But I don't really, if I lie down and read, then see you later.
Yeah, but, okay.
If I'm reading during the day, I'm sitting up.
Yeah, okay. No, I like sort of, I was doing, on the way home, I was alternating between watching, what I was binge watching was The Crown season 2.
Oh my God, speak to me. I've watched the whole thing.
So I was doing some watching of that, and then I'd watch 2 or 3 episodes, and then I'd read a chapter of Fire and Fury, which is the book about Donald Trump, which
we'll
save for another time. But so that was a pretty pleasant long haul flight.
Yeah.
As pleasant as those horrible things can be. But okay, so The Crown season 2. Also, I feel like I should say, like, we can't really talk about things and guarantee that there won't be a spoiler. I'll try
not
to.
It's all happened. It's all true.
Yeah, but you forget about stuff. And so then it does feel like.
It's not a spoiler if it's happened.
True.
It's like, okay, so we watched this OJ series. Should there be a spoiler? I don't know. Although a great television series about a real series of events actually somehow chemically makes you forget it even as you're watching
it. It does.
It recreates it as the ability to shock you. Like you've said a bunch of times that you're watching that OJ chase and you're thinking, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Is he going to shoot himself?
It was crazy.
But I think, look, be warned, Chatters. Various historical events that actually happened will be mentioned in this discussion.
And if you're not familiar
also,
with them.
The Beatles have totally broken up.
If you're
sorry,
not,
sales.
Oh, that brings me to my Paul McCartney interview.
Oh,
if you might not be familiar with this era of British history, so, you know, anyway, whatever.
It's suck the it current
up.
Era of British
suck
history.
Suck it up,
like,
listeners.
What are you
no, it's
on
not.
About.
The 1950s aren't the current era of British history.
It's current-ish.
Okay, so I think that firstly it has just sent me down so many rabbit holes about people that I thought I would never be interested
in.
Like former British Prime
Lord
Minister
Snowden.
Lord Snowden, Harold Macmillan.
Yes, Macmillan.
Just, you know,
Macmillan's wife, more centrally.
Absolutely. So all of that stuff has been absolutely fascinating. And I just feel like my list of things that I want to read now because of this show is just amazing. It also just makes me I'd be really interested to see some opinion polling out of Britain about the royal family and the Queen. Surely it has to have had a positive impact.
Well, that's the thing. And the thing that I want, I mean, what I would really like is to have the makers of it right here so that we could interview them, because the series is so intimate and it goes into some very controversial elements of the relationship between the Queen and Prince Philip. Oh my God, the revelations about the Queen's uncle, the abdicated king who raced off with Wallace Simpson, they're just extraordinary. And in fact, Jeremy and I, when we watch it, we end up doing a half hour of Googling after the episode because you're just like, is that for real?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, totally
well,
is.
I mean, a lot of moments in this season, you know, really stick with me. But there's an episode about halfway through where there's a lot of emphasis on him and it's about his ties to the Nazi party. And the Queen sort of learns about the depth of it and is appalled and, you know, rightly believes it would be very damaging to the royals if it ever got out. And then at the end of the episode, they show slideshow of the actual historical photos of the real David and Wallace Simpson. with Adolf Hitler inspecting SS troops. Like, it was, I think my jaw was on the ground.
Unnervingly similar to the actors who were cast to play them in The Crown. It's just,
I reckon my mouth was hanging open. I could not believe it.
It's a million-dollar television moment.
It was really, really amazing. The other thing, too, with the relationship between Philip and Elizabeth, I think that they have been so clever in the way that they've done it, because there's things that have happened in that relationship that have been, you know, rumoured, but nobody knows for a fact. Yeah. So, you know, he's meant to be a bit of a bounder and a bit of a playboy, but nobody ever knows for sure, yeah. You know, is that the case? And so there's a scene in the final episode where she makes it clear that she knows that she thinks he's cheated on her.
Well, she says, you know, I'm happy, I can look the other way.
And she shows a photograph of a woman that she found in his luggage. And when she confronts him with it, the dialogue sort of stops and it's silent for quite a while and nobody says anything, but the actors' faces sort of move through a range of various emotions.
That
was a literal clang. And
that's the interruption for today. Pretty low level, wasn't it, really?
It was. And then he basically...
otherwise it'd be Big Bird jumping through the door or something.
He basically says, you need to know that I'm in... You know, I'm in this relationship. It's tough. Marriages are tough generally. Ours has got some particularly weird things going on, but I am in this, regardless of, you know, the sort of noise or whatever else. And I just thought, geez, it was clever because it allowed you as a viewer to, you could decide for yourself or not whether you think that that really happened. But they, as the filmmakers, haven't chosen to say, we're going to portray it that this definitely happened.
Well, it's portrayed with all the complications of a normal relationship, I think, which is in a way the most extraordinary thing about it, because it has every other element of the absurd contraption that is the royal family. But then in the end, these sort of human themes are all too common, I think. But the thing that puzzles me about it is... have they had any kind of assistance from the royal family or the royal establishment at all? Because, like, it looks like they've had access to some buildings.
Yeah, but I guess
maybe they haven't. It's the most expensive television series ever made, right? So maybe everything is just
they've just built a replica Windsor Castle.
But it would be, and I find myself thinking about this a lot while I'm watching it, because I just think, oh, no, that would never stay in if the palace had any kind of cooperative role in it.
There's no way, I reckon, that you could have offered the palace any sort of role or consulting or anything like that, because then I think there'd be a risk that you would feel co-opted. I think you'd have to not have that.
Yeah.
But maybe you would use people who had worked for the royals as consultants or something.
Yeah.
But now that it's come out and it's a big success, and I think even warts and all, it is so positive for the royals. I mean, I wonder now if perhaps maybe they're cooperating. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you'd want to maintain 100% full freedom.
Yeah, they can't be in any way involved, I guess.
Particularly because we're talking now, other than the Queen and Philip, about people who, I mean, Charles has just come into it in the previous season in a big way, but we're talking about mostly people who are dead. But in the coming seasons, we're going to be talking about people who are alive and the future of the crown.
Yeah. So do you feel more positively about the Queen, for instance, after having watched it?
I have always admired the Queen because I thought... she, you know, has handled herself with incredible dignity over a long, long period of time. And she's really probably the last towering figure of the 20th century who's still alive. And also just that I was thinking about, you know, when she dies, like she's been as present in my life as the rising of the sun. Like since I've been born, it's been the Queen, you know, on the currency. Like it's just... I went to school in the era where you sang God Save the Queen in the morning when you arrived at school. So I've always admired her, but this program has made me feel sort of, I was going to say more fondly towards her, but really more fondly towards the character that they have created of her.
Yeah.
And also has made me think about her more as a human being and what it must be like as a human being to have that role.
Yeah. Oh, no, I definitely have more sympathy for her. And partly because when you spell out the sort of absurd demands that were made of her as a very young woman, particularly when, like, there's this incredible line where she's – I mean, her relationship with her sister Margaret is incredibly fraught. And it does – the whole series evokes very clearly – the absurdity of what it would be like to be one of those peripheral royals without a real job, like an accident of birth stopped you from having a really significant job. And at one point the Queen, played by
Claire Foy,
so brilliantly. I mean, her eyes and her lips should get separate Golden Globes, I think. But she says, she's actually having a conversation with Jackie Kennedy. This scene, I think, is so unconvincing. I thought that scene was just ridiculous. But
yeah,
she was talking about being incredibly shy, and over the course of her reign, she has periodically bolted to Balmoral and just gone shooting deer and, you know, stumping around in rubber boots, which is obviously what makes her happier. But imagine having an accident of birth thrust you into that job that you weren't confident in, that you didn't feel educated sufficiently for, and that you essentially at heart really didn't want to do. You didn't love meeting people. What you wanted to do is stump around and go gardening. But your sister, who loves that stuff, has got nothing to do and really just ends up carousing her life away.
And also for your partner, I mean, one of the lines that really stuck with me was they're having a row about their marriage and sort of trying to put everything out on the table, and he says, all right, well, you know, who's going to go first? Oh, no, sorry. If I've learned one thing over the course of this, it's that I always go second. And it was just like, man, and that's not just him, although I think it's particularly hard for a husband and a man to be thrust into that role the whole time. But everyone, her sister, her mother, everyone like goes that. Second. Everybody.
At some point she says to her aunt, you know, well, as the head of this family, you think, oh, that's right, because you are really. Yeah. But I do feel more sympathetic towards Prince Philip as well after watching this. I mean, I actually, weirdly enough, I was when we were shooting The House, I was interviewing Tony Abbott, and I was just sort of making small talk, and I said, I said to him, have you been watching The Crown? And of course, you know, he only watches things on Cine Film or something. He's like, what, Netflix? You know, it's just not, hasn't got to Netflix yet, I don't think. He's just got past Olivetti. So I was telling him about it. He's going, oh, all right. And I said, you know, the funny thing about it, and like, I didn't even think before I said this, but I said to him, oh, look, the weird thing about it is that I'm, after the first series, I'm just much more sympathetic to Prince Philip than I ever was.
Yeah.
And so, but then Abbott just says, worthy of a knighthood, you reckon, Annabelle? I'm like, oh, no, that was ridiculous. And he's like, that was really funny.
But all of them, like Philip, as well, you just think more about what it must have been like to be a human being done that. I mean, I cried my eyes out in the Charles episode where he sent to boarding school.
Oh, my God, that's just so traumatic.
Oh, it was awful.
And you just think, oh, so that's why you're a bit odd.
Oh, it was absolutely shocking. And, you know, it's not like it's an entirely sympathetic portrait of the Queen either, because some of the scenes around that and the decision for him to be sent to a boarding school that was clearly ill-suited, and that they all knew that it was going to break him.
Yeah. But he gets sucked into the power vortex because Prince Philip really wants him to go to this terrifying school where you get
beaten
up.
That he went to,
because he feels like it made him a man, and he feels that Charles is a bit of a ponce and just needs to be stomped on a few times.
And the Queen sort of just lets it roll.
Because she's got to give him something. So poor old Charles becomes that. Look, this could be Keeping Up with the Kardashians. We're now just
totally.
Like, yeah, and it is. It's like a fabulous soap. It's like a fabulous soap that is also real. And they spent just a huge amount of money making, so it's just glorious.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was equally as good as the first one. There's only one shot in it of John Lithgow, who plays Winston Churchill in season one, fabulously.
John Lithgow is
brilliant. Love him.
The best thing about the first series, I reckon. He's just so good.
He's the best in everything. He was the best thing about Footloose.
Yeah.
He's great.
You're right. I forgot about that.
But you've seen the Church, because there's a few Churchill films that have come out.
I've seen all of them.
Right.
And I now have this really intense and problematic, something I didn't expect to be happening to me at this point in my life. I've got Churchill confusion. I've seen so many Churchill films and series that he's been in that I'm like, which Churchill was that? Was that Lithgow Churchill?
Oh, classic.
Or was that Gary Oldman Churchill? I can't remember.
So there's the Crown Churchill, and then what are the other things that are
out? There's a film Churchill, which is Brian Cox as Churchill and Miranda Richardson as Clementine.
Right.
And that is, it came out last year. I actually saw it on a plane at some point, and it's great. I really loved it. I'm, you know, sort of interested in that period of history, as is everybody. Mm-hmm. But this film is quite narrow in that it's about Churchill's decision-making up to and including the D-Day invasion, the landing. And it's really about the interplay between him and General Eisenhower and the king. And it's basically a sort of a drawing room drama. You know, it's shot inside. They haven't even tried to reproduce the D-Day landing itself. It's all about the diplomacy.
Oh, that sounds great.
It's really good. And it's fascinating because it shows you, because every bit of Churchill's life that you pick shows you something different. And this particular part of it shows him slightly losing it. He's being cut out of the decision making. And so it's this period of great stress and he feels irrelevant. And Miranda Richardson is really great as Clementine. It shows his rages and, you know, obviously he's pissed the whole time and all of that. Mm. So it's really intense examination of a short period of time. In The Queen, The Crown, obviously it's about his relationship with the Queen, which is something different.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's a lot of stuff that he, you know, he deals with her father a lot, and that's what you see in Churchill.
Yeah.
But in the most recent one that's just come out, which is called The Darkest Hour, that's Churchill interacting he's interacting a lot more with the king. He's
so it's her father again, back to that era, World War II.
Yeah, and guess who the King George is played by? Ben Mendelsohn. I am not even kidding.
No way.
Yeah.
Get out of the city.
It is amazing.
Wow. Really amazing.
So this is Churchill. It starts with Churchill becoming Prime Minister. Mm. So, Mendelsohn's incredible.
Wow. Okay.
He's so versatile, that guy.
Amazing.
And he just slips into slightly hesitant monarch with a stutter, like you just wouldn't believe.
I think we've said it before with Mendo. He can
Mendo.
Mendo, me and Mendo. Mendo. I like this.
Shit, are you joking?
He can switch effortlessly between terrifying and menacing and sort of quizzling, weak chinned, slightly.
Yeah. He's perfect.
Yeah.
As the king. He's amazing.
Oh, God, that sounds great.
It's really good. Yeah.
So of those two.
And also Clementine is played by Kristen Scott Thomas, which is a really great piece of casting.
If you only felt like you had the appetite to watch one Churchill film, which of the two would you?
Oh, I'd probably go The Darkest Hour.
And why is it that all of a sudden, like a heap of, like when that Truman Capote film came out, another Truman Capote film.
Why? How? Yeah. I know. Is there something in the ether? And like, I love that there's enough room for them. And I actually am quite enjoying getting different glimpses of that period because it's really, you know, it's quite, there's so many absorbing elements about Churchill as well. So that I think he's a character who can take different kind of approaches. Oh, what about that bit in the first series of The Crown where Churchill is sitting for the portrait?
Yeah, that's right.
And the artist is like kind of, because the portrait of Churchill, and I can't remember the artist's name, he hated the portrait, right? And the artist spent a lot of time in conversation and almost like just psychoanalysis with him.
Right.
And the portrait is quite dark and brooding. Churchill hated it. And after his death, Clementine burnt it or had it burned.
Oh.
And it's actually like it's an incredible portrait. Like it only survives in photographs now.
By a very well-regarded British artist.
Yeah, whose name I heroically can't. I'm just going to look it up because it's worth remembering, and even though I've forgotten it, it's just my general Churchill confusion.
While you do that, speaking of product made about real life events. When I was overseas, I saw the film The Post with Meryl Streep as Catherine Graham and Tom Hanks as Ben Bradley. So it's basically about the Pentagon Papers and the leaking of that material by Daniel Ellsberg, and then The Post and The New York Times basically competing against each other to be the ones to, you know, get that material out and to sort of get around the courts, which are trying to block the publication of it. And so it's sort of about, you know, The Washington Post was it was sort of the start of when the Post was about to enter its golden era with all the Watergate stuff. But basically, Catherine Graham has to make some really tough calls about whether or not they're going to publish stuff that, you know, the government's claiming is treasonous, basically, and she might get thrown in jail.
That,
memoir is one of my favourites, personal history. Look, it was well done. It certainly held my interest. I thought Tom Hanks was an excellent Ben Bradley. Meryl Streep, you know, just throwing this into my Dickens thing, she just leaves me cold. Meryl?
Throwing this into your Dickens thing.
Into my Dickens
bag. Please
don't
ever say that phrase again.
Meryl Streep always makes me feel like she's one of those people who's like, oh, please, look at my acting. Because even what I just did then, she was doing it all the time, like, oh, real people don't speak without saying and ah or stumbling over their words, so I'm going to stumble over my words. And to me, it always feels obvious and like I'm watching Meryl try to seem like – and I mean, I know that this is a very – I know nothing about acting and I like I'm a bit party of one here to say that I don't like Meryl Streep's acting, but every time I see a film with her in it, I think, Meryl.
Next live podcast we do, someone will be in the audience. Hello, I'm the South Australian president of the Meryl Streep Appreciation Society.
But notwithstanding Meryl being annoying, it was a good film, but I didn't absolutely love it. But it did make me nostalgic for the golden days of newspapers.
Did you know, just on Tom Hanks, did you know that he's written a book of short stories?
I knew that. This is recent, right?
Yeah. I think it's just out. I've got a copy of it, which I haven't started reading yet, but it seems to be incredibly well reviewed. Apparently it's really good.
He is one of those people, he's right up the top of my interview wish list because every interview I see with him, he's so delightful and warm and friendly and just seems like an absolutely great guy.
Apparently he's a very nice person to have on set.
He'd be the number one person I'd be disappointed if he was outed as a sex pest.
Oh, don't say that.
I think
I'm having trouble with
Aziz
Ansari.
Oh, I don't really want to go into it because I just feel like it can only result in us being endlessly trolled. But I tweeted.
Why don't I just grab your knee and then leave it at that?
I tweeted a piece out of the Atlantic the other day about this issue.
Oh, that Atlantic piece?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's red hot. That one is firing people up all over the world.
It is.
Well, let's not get into discussion of it, but just note that. That Atlantic piece about the article that the woman wrote about her disastrous date with Aziz Ansari is like, it's about the most commented on article that I've seen on this, and it's very provocative.
And so all I'll say is I'm looking forward to season 3 of Master of None.
Okay. Listen, that portrait of Winston Churchill was by Graham Sutherland, and look, just Google it if you can, because it's a tragedy that it's been burned because he looks – it's this sort of he looks grumpy. That's why
portrait.
He hated it, but it's actually
– it's a great portrait.
It's exactly
that's
the way you picture him. Anyway, so I could go on for about 4 hours about paintings that their subjects didn't like in the field of politics, but that would be boring for you and everybody.
Now
maybe another time we'll do it.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk about going to Blue Hill in New York, but I want to have plenty of time to do that, so I might do it in our next podcast.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But can I just quickly mention a couple of other little things that I did in New York? That
was so great. Please. Clang, clang.
That I think
clang,
people
clang,
would like
clang.
To hear about. I saw Bette Midler in Hello, Dolly.
Wow, you say you've only got a few minutes to talk about this?
There's not much to say other than it was just absolutely fantastic. And it was just, you just felt like, wow, you don't get more Broadway than watching Bette Midler, you know, on 44th
Street.
What do you
wear to a night out like that, Sales?
It was minus 15. I was basically
you wore a sleeping bag.
Sleeping bag and a black eye. When she came on stage, I reckon the audience applauded for about 4 minutes. Everyone was so excited to see her.
What's her current look? I don't mean to be shallow about all this,
just
but I just want to know what everyone was wearing.
Same as what she's always looks like, but she was dressed in period costume for the show, of course. But, you know, it was so interesting because I was watching her thinking, she certainly doesn't have the largest vocal range, but what she's got, she uses incredibly, but her presence, I mean, the star quality and the ability to like hold the room's attention was just fantastic. I got into a YouTube rabbit hole when I got back to my hotel room after seeing that of Bette clips, and I watched a very famous clip apparently that I've never seen before, which is on the final episode of The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Bette Midler is the last ever guest, and sings with a pianist One for the Road. It was...
What a great idea. You'd just be slapping yourself on the back for years as the producer if you had that idea, right?
It was like, it was spine-tingling, and I do not know how Johnny Carson could speak after it. It was, and Robin Williams was sitting on the couch. He'd been the other guest on the show. It was just one of the greatest moments I thought I'd seen in the history of television. It was brilliant. And then that led me into a rabbit hole into once I was on Bet, then I got into Barbara Streisand. I watched a documentary about Barbara doing a – it was sort of built around a live show in Miami and they had some backstage access. And the greatest bit was that the show was had an interval.
You are a tragic figure. You really are.
The show had an interval. This was 2 a.m. in New York. I was in my hotel room watching a Barbara Streisand doco. In the interval of the show, Barbara rings a place in Miami called Joe's Seafood, which is a very famous seafood restaurant that does stone crab, lobster and all that stuff. And she goes, "It's Barbara." And the guy goes, "Oh, Miss Streisand, oh, hello. Aren't you doing a show tonight?" She was like, "Yeah, it's intermission. I just want to make sure that you've got my order for after the show." And he goes, "Oh, okay." And then she rattles off, "I want 5 stone crab and I want that fried chicken you do for children. I'd like 2 serves of that." And then she just lists off this gigantic list of food.
What, this is all for her or for her mates?
And her husband and her manager or whoever. Yeah. And she wants it all in the hotel room the second that she comes off from the show. And so she comes off stage, picks up her little white dog, and then the last shot's her sitting around the table chowing down on the fried chicken. It was so good.
It's Barbara.
Now, let's call an end to this and I'll talk about Blue Hill next time.
Let's knock this on the head. I've had enough.